Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 12th of April 2015. My name's TRP Watson and this week I'm joined by Johnny Fox, Nick from Partially Obstructed View and Web Cowgirl. We're now going to talk about Dead Sheep at the Park Theatre. This is directed by Ian Talbot and written by the journalist Jonathan Maitland, who, by the way, is also giving us an audience with Jimmy Savile at the Park later this year. The play stars Steve Nallon reprising his spitting image role as Margaret Thatcher, James Wilby as Geoffrey Howe, Jill Baker as Elspeth Howe, and Graham Seed, Tim Wallers, and John Walk playing pretty much everybody else. It deals with the story of the lead-up to Geoffrey Howe's famous House of Commons resignation speech, which in turn led to Margaret Thatcher's downfall, or at least led to Michael Heseltine's challenge, which eventually led to her resignation. I think it's a fairly well put together piece, and it's very funny and very informative, although I did think most of the people at the theatre on the night were people who remember the situation. In fact, I think there was at least one BBC politics correspondent in the audience on the night I went. So I think this is going to appeal most to people who remember this situation and remember, well, the Thatcher government. In fact, there's a big picture of the cabinet taken sometime in the mid-80s, although this play deals mostly with the late 80s, or 89 and 1990. But there is a picture of the cabinet, big picture of the cabinet, up on the backdrop. And I was rather distressed that I could name all but about five of the people up there. I could probably not name more than five of the present cabinet. So it did seem to put me where most of my political knowledge seems to be. The play is telling the story of this relationship between Margaret Thatcher and Geoffrey Howe, the way that he, in some ways, helped her out by being a very firm and, well, they seem to say that as Chancellor of the Exchequer, his budgets worked out and everything was fine and dandy. I think other people might have disagreements with that. He then moved to the Foreign Office, where he became almost enamoured of the European project and found that Margaret Thatcher was drifting away from Europe and was becoming Eurosceptic or even Europhobic. These tensions build up until he is effectively sidelined, made to be leader of the House and deputy prime minister instead of foreign secretary, and then eventually feeling that he can do nothing else but to resign and possibly get Thatcher booted out, although I don't think that was his aim in doing so necessarily. Although it is very entertaining and there are some lovely characterizations, I mean, I did enjoy Tim Waller's playing both Alan Clark and Bernard Ingham. There's some, as I say, very nice pieces in there, but it is a little bit sketchy, and also, well, it really comes down to Steve Nallon. Now, there's nothing wrong with Steve Nallon. He does a wonderful impersonation of Margaret Thatcher, but it is an impersonation. I mean, he gets her bang on. I mean, although it's rather strange to have somebody, you know, a man playing a woman, but he was always very good as Margaret Thatcher in Spitting Image, and he really nails her mannerisms and her voice. But I wanted more deep character, and it's almost as if you're putting the cart before the horse, saying, well, Steve Nallon isn't giving me deep character, but it's actually the play that doesn't allow for deep character. And you do wonder if Jonathan Maitland and Ian Talbot had sort of said, well, yes, this is a good idea to write this play. We'll get Steve Nallon to play Thatcher, and therefore the play gets written with an impersonation rather than a proper actress coming in and doing it. I mean, I'm thinking about Handbagged, where I saw Fenella Woolgar and Stella Gonnett playing Margaret Thatcher and really nailing her extremely well and really getting the character and a real depth of it. And we don't get a depth of character from Thatcher. We get an awful lot of comic lines, but we don't really get inside her. We do get inside Geoffrey Howe. James Wilby playing, not really looking like Geoffrey Howe, I thought, but playing this really apparently likable guy. And you also get a very good performance from Jill Baker playing his activist wife. I think I knew about things like her camping out for a week to protest the homeless and being a bit of an activist. But in this play, you get this idea that she is really putting steel into Geoffrey Howe's backbone. So while she's not necessarily writing his resignation speech, it is her, the play alleges, that brings him to the point where he can write that speech and can be, well, fierce. The play, of course, gets its title from the quote from Dennis Healy that being attacked by Geoffrey Howe was rather like being savaged by a dead sheep. John, tell me more about this play and what you thought about it.
I rather liked it, but it is my political era, and I did live through all these dramatic elements that really kind of pave the way for the change in politics that we now have that is very much more disrespectful, and the combats are played out in sound bites on television rather than across the floor of the House of Commons as they perhaps were more in the mid-80s. What I have to say is that although it is my era, I took with me a friend who must be born in the early 90s, and he wasn't even around at the time all this happened, but he found it completely engaging and followed the plot and the politics every bit as well as I did, possibly even better. So it's not just a piece that will appeal to us Wrinkleys who remember Mrs. Thatcher's era. It's interesting anyway. And I think it's interesting because it's a piece of modern writing, a modern production that doesn't depict Mrs. Thatcher as a complete monster, as almost everything else on the fringe will and does, especially in this sort of wave of stuff that's coming out around election time. But by not depicting her as a monster and having her portrayed by Stephen Allen, whose voice in Spitting Image was so perfect, you are right, I think. It does her in a way a disservice because she is still seen as a kind of caricature figure. You're right, I don't think Jonathan Maitland knew her well enough to draw out the sort of characterization that Fenella Woolgar in particular, as the sort of younger middle-aged Mrs. Thatcher, portrayed so very well in Handbagged. Or even Hayden Gwynn in The Audience, although I thought that was a little bit more lurching towards caricature because I think Hayden Gwynn's about a foot and a half taller than Mrs. Thatcher. Apart from everything else, she looked a bit strange. But I thought that in capturing the tea room and committee room arguments, in depicting quite a lot of the grey men, as they used to be described, the women who surrounded Mrs. Thatcher, they did very well with this piece. In fact, I would have liked more grey men, and I would have liked them delineated a little bit more clearly and separately. They obviously play to the potential for a younger audience by explaining very carefully who everybody is and what they're about to say or do. But that's also because all the ancillary characters are played by just three very good actors, Graham Seed, John Walk, and Tim Wallace. But some of their characterizations are so delicious, you'd really like more of them. I mean, I really, really wanted to see much more of Tim Wallace as Alan Clark. I mean, he had the old shagger down to a fine art, and the kind of sandpaper conflict between him and Elspeth Howe was just wonderful. You could have much more of a scene of the night he came to dinner and she almost threw him out. I also knew of Elspeth slightly. I think I remember her mostly as a governor of the BBC, and I'm not so sure I recall her as being a great campaigner for the homeless. And she was on the Equal Opportunities Commission, but she wasn't head of it, as I think this play suggests. I think she was deputy or something like that for quite a while. You said that there had been quite a few political people in the audience, and I think Robert Peston went the night before I did and had been tweeting about it, how much he liked it. The most interesting option would be that Geoffrey and Elspeth Howe get invited because they are both still alive. I think they're in their very late 80s or very early 90s, but, you know, still living in retirement. And I think they're a fascinating couple. Aren't they the only couple both to have peerages in their own right or something like that, because she became a baroness as well as being Lady Howe when he was knighted? Politically, I don't think it has very much to say. There are some echoes from this era, just to explain the difference of opinion between Mrs. Thatcher and many of her ministers that really brought the government to the brink of collapse was that she wouldn't accept consensus view about the European monetary union, or it was called the exchange rate mechanism in those days, but it was the precursor to what is now the euro. And Thatcher was sceptical, suspicious of it, and didn't want us to join. And most of the rest of the cabinet thought we should be playing along with our European partners. Now, funnily enough, Thatcher turns out to have been right on that point, because what we now know about what's happened to the euro with Greece's somewhat illegal entry into it and how it's fallen in value so much over recent years, you know, we were right to stay out. And I think quite a few of the other sort of Eurosceptic remarks Mrs. Thatcher makes in this piece were echoed by Nigel Farage in the Seven Way Leaders debate. So it's still topical, if you like, even though it's clearly a very historical piece. I thought James Wilby was very good as Geoffrey Howe, because he's depicted in this Dennis Healy phrase as a dead sheep. He wasn't a lustrous figure. He was a very good speaker. I mean, he really was not a rhetorical orator, but he was an interesting and engaging man to listen to. He had a very warm, very rich voice that was quite soothing to even when he had something unpalatable to say. And although they're not really lookalikes, I think it probably gives him a handsome romantic edge, not often accorded to politicians, to have someone quite as attractive as James Wilby playing him. But I thought he got the inflections right, and I thought he got the divided loyalty in what were effectively two very solid marriages, his actual marriage to Elspeth, which has now endured for 60 years or so, and his political marriage to Margaret, because they really were inseparable colleagues, and he was her closest confidant for a very, very long time. Would this play survive or be as good without Stephen Allen? And I'd like to see it tested. I can't immediately think of an actress, except, you know, maybe one of those we've mentioned, like Finella Wolgar, who would take it on and carry it with the same effect. I think casting a man in this woman's role at a time when Mrs. Thatcher was very much the dominant of an otherwise all-male cabinet, I thought that was quite interesting, and giving her a masculine frame, a masculine stature among these sort of weak and flapping men, I thought that was quite an effective stage technique. So I wonder if when it's revived in the future, it'll also be played by a man. So it's not on the grand scale of this house at the National Theatre. And in fact, I wonder if it lost an opportunity to move more into that category, and perhaps in some future restaging it would be enlarged and enhanced in that sort of way. As I say, it could do with more ancillary characters who are more clearly identified and look a bit more like the people they're playing. But I do think it's worth a visit, and you know, it's another good notch on the Park's gun belt.
We're now going to talk about Gypsy at the Savoy Theatre. This is the musical, book by Arthur Lawrence, music by Jules Stein, lyrics by Stephen Sondheim, and originally directed and choreographed by Jerome Robbins. It is being presented here by the Chichester Festival Theatre, directed by Jonathan Kent, and stars Imelda Staunton as Mama Rose, Lara Pulver as Louise, and Peter Davison as Herb. Nick, tell me what you thought of this, and tell me a little bit more about the play.
I've never seen the show before, or the film, so I think everyone else on here has a slightly different perspective on it. But certainly a couple of the songs are very familiar, because they're kind of standards, especially for anybody who wants to show off their voice. I think it's that kind of show. I did know quite a lot about it going in, because I think it's one of those shows that's sort of in, maybe not so much here, but so much in the American consciousness that you can't kind of watch an American TV show without dropping some kind of reference to Gypsy. So it's kind of the childhood and adolescence of Gypsy Rose Lee, whose her real name was Louise, and she's played here by Lara Pulver. But the real focus is kind of the pushy stage mother, Mama Rose, who's Imelda Staunton. And she's one of these kind of force of nature characters who will persistently kind of push both her children into kind of a stardom that she never had. What's interesting about the story, which I take it is, I know it's kind of a fictionalized version of the true story, but I think what is true is that Louise was never kind of meant to be the star. Her younger sister June, who's played here by Gemma Sutton as a kind of teenager and adult. We do have, there's some early scenes where there's kind of these creepy child talent shows. She's kind of the one with all the singing and dancing talent, and Louise is kind of her backup. And when June kind of elopes and gets sick and tired of sort of the failing world of vaudeville, Mama Rose kind of promotes Louise to the star, whether she's got any talent for it or not. And one way or another, they'd find out what it is that she will turn out to be good at. So it's an interesting kind of dynamic, and I think it's worth mentioning Laura Pulver doing, I think, a very good job of, I think it's a very convincing kind of progression from sort of the wallflower who does what she's told and kind of isn't very good at anything but will give it a go because she's told to, into kind of one of the most overtly sexual figures of that time in America. And I think it's a really kind of tricky thing to do, to kind of go from virtually invisible to busting out, so to speak, in that way. And I think it's worth mentioning it because obviously Mama Rose is the real kind of starring role. And I think people are probably going to forget about the rest of the cast just in talking about Imelda Staunton, because, I mean, she is fantastic. I mean, it's funny, I think, because she's probably now best known for her film work, it's easy to forget how good a musical theatre star she is. And she, vocally, she really is up to the part. What I thought was interesting is, I mean, as I say, this is kind of one of these shows where the songs are kind of, I suppose before there was Wicked, that this was what you'd go for if you wanted to kind of belt a song out and show that you could hit every note at the highest volume known to man. And I think what's interesting about Imelda Staunton, where you see that she's not just a great singer, but a really great actress as well, is I think especially at the end you see it in Rose's Turn, the kind of there's a subtlety to her performance that kind of balances out the unsubtlety of the music. And I think it's probably, like I said, I've got nothing to compare it to, but it seems an excellent production of it to me, and it's a very good kind of night at the theatre. But I know that John knows this much better than I do, so I'm sure he'll have a lot to compare it to as well.
I'm afraid I do, yes. I first caught Gypsy Fever when I was a teenager and worked a summer in London when the same year that Angela Lansbury played Mama Rose, rather, in Gypsy in the West End. And I think because I've been fortunate enough to work in both England and America, I've probably seen every major revival since. Certainly Patti LuPone, Tyne Daly, Bernadette Peters, and I think Diana Rigg the last time it was at Chichester. So I do know the show pretty well. And if any of them haven't been able to remember some of the words, I could probably have gone up there and shown them how to do it. And I often say that I think Gypsy is the best written musical in the musical theatre canon, because it is Julie Stein absolutely at the top of his musical form, and aided and abetted really by, I think, about a 19-year-old Stephen Sondheim under Oscar Hammerstein's tutelage, producing the lyrics. And if you listen to the sharpness of the lyrics, particularly in something like the Three Strippers song, You've Got to Get a Gimmick, it's very knowing and very adult and very sophisticated for a 19-year-old writer, even one quite so besotted by musical theatre as Sondheim was at the time. And I wondered if he peaked too early, really, because this is still some of his best surviving work. But this time round, I found myself watching the first act and wondering if it was quite as good as I remember it. And I'm only talking about the structure of the musical, not the production, which is very good indeed. But whether we wait too long for the two main characters, the domineering, determined Mother Rose and the tomboyish and shy daughter Louise, to emerge into what they're going to become. Louise into Gypsy Rose Lee, the stripper, and Rose into some measure of self-awareness when everybody does finally leave her, as they have been doing throughout her life, and she stands alone and does this magnificent piece called Rose's Turn, in which she shows both what her musical theatre capability would have been had she been an actress herself, and her sense of loss and withdrawal at not achieving her own dreams and pushing too hard her own children. I think that makes the show unbalanced. And the other thing that unbalances it is that what happens in the first act is that you get an awful lot of rather childish songs rehashed a lot of times. You know, it's like The Sound of Music, in fact, which is, it has suffers from the same mistake that in the first half of The Sound of Music, all you get in the stage version are endless repeats of Do Re Mi and So Long Farewell and very infantile songs, and the good stuff comes later. So it does with Gypsy. You don't get the really, and apart from Everything's Coming Up Roses, which is the first act closer, you don't get the really good stuff until act two. But in terms of the performances, this is as well cast almost as I've seen. And for me, the best Rose has always been Tyne Daly. I thought she was stunning in the way that she played Rose as slightly younger than most actresses do. It's normally a part you come to in your mid to late 50s, like Imelda Staunton. And Tyne Daly, I think, was only about 43, 44 when she did it. So she had a certain almost sexiness, if you like. And the relationship between her and Herbie, who is the admirer who becomes her the troupe's manager and agent and fixer, was a genuine romantic one. And you couldn't believe that feisty Mama Rose would find anything appealing in this great lumbering elephant of Peter Davison. I cannot understand why producers consistently cast as Herbie an actor with television credentials who can't sing a note. You know, Kevin Whateley didn't make a greater job of it down in Chichester. And when I heard that he wasn't going to come into London, I thought, oh, great, you know, here's a chance of Alexander Hansen or some other more mature leading man to swoop in and actually sing Herbie as well as act it. No, not happening here, because Davison is quite poor and I think lets the team down. I'd be interested to see if he survives the run. Among the rest of the cast, Laura Pulver, I mean, amazing. You and I, Nick, both saw her yesterday on what must have been one of the toughest days in her working life, because she had a 5 a.m. call to do Saturday Kitchen live on television and then two punishing shows of Gypsy. So if anybody deserves a Sunday off, it's Lara. I thought she was very good once she emerged into the Gypsy role. And that's possibly a reason I would like this transformation to come earlier in the show than it does, because, you know, you relaxed and enjoyed her once you gained the confidence in the stripping. And although she's very, very good at the complicated stuff of, you know, not quite being in time with the music and missing the steps and going the wrong way in the dance routines for the troupe that she as a child is supposed to belong to, her best moments are definitely when she's in the glamorous gown and behaving like the queen of striptease that she became. Rest of the cast, well, surprised to see Gemma Sutton as June. It's a thankless part and it's also a cursed part. Part of theatre folklore, if you like, but no one who ever played June or the boy she runs off with, the dancer Tulsa, who has a good solo number called All I Need Is the Girl in the show. Nobody who ever played those parts ever hit the big time, ever became a star as a result of it. And since Gemma Sutton is so definitely on the rise because of her wonderful Julie Jordan in Carousel at the Arcola, I hope this hasn't won't be a blight on her career. Maybe she's going to be the first one to lay the ghost of Dainty June. The scene stealer in the second act is the number the three strippers in the burlesque house do. You've got to get a gimmick. And that is a test of character and endurance and singing lung power for any actress over 40. And the casting here, it really, I can't imagine it being much finer. Louise Gold, hate to harp on about people's age, but, you know, must be pushing the big 6-0, getting her gams out and being Mazeppa and stripping with a trumpet in a gladiator outfit. You know, that's got to have a Best Supporting Actress badge attached to it somewhere. It is just so fine. She really is. She has the awful rasping voice of the woman who created the part, Chotsey Foley, you'll hear her on the Ethel Merman CD, and everybody else who's done it ever since has tried to get this sort of guttural rasp into the voice, and she has it perfectly. And I also liked Anita Louise Coombe, you know, a veteran Roxy Hart and Velma Kelly coming up smelling of roses as Tessie Tura, the balletic stripper, the one who thinks she's a lady. She's more refined than the others who take their clothes off in the burlesque house. House. And it's the biggest of the three stripper parts. And she carried that off very well. And then beautiful Julie Legrand, you know, lovely, delicate actress all her working life, now coming up as a coarse stripper with she plays Electra, but also doubles the part of Mr. Grantziger's secretary in the scene where the troupe is being auditioned for the Grantziger circuit, which would be, you know, their last ditch attempt at legitimacy before they kind of descend into burlesque. So three really lovely cameos that lift the second act of the show no end. Not that it needs lifting. This is a very fine production. The transition from Chichester has made it a little bit less intimate, because obviously at Chichester you've got that sort of hexagonal stage, hexagonal theatre, and the auditorium wraps around much more of the stage. Here this is definitely proscenium with a runway across and beyond the orchestra, where both Rose and Louise somewhat precariously have to strut their stuff. I think that could do a little bit of reinforcement. What else to say? It's a great story. It's not all the story, though, and I'm very surprised no one's ever written a sequel to Gypsy, because we leave the characters at the point at which Gypsy Rose Lee herself is probably only about 20, something like that, having just emerged as a star at Minsky's Burlesque. But once she became successful, she invested in a number of businesses for her mother to run, one of which, curiously, is a lesbian boarding house on West End Avenue in the Upper West Side of New York, where Rose, if you read biographies of the time, had a succession of the most astonishing customers. Make a tremendous play, if not a musical in itself. The character of Rose is a dynamic monster, but she was a slightly more frightening woman than the musical allows you to believe. For example, when June and Bobby Reed, who became her husband, who is the character that Tulsa is modelled on, they did actually elope when June was only 15 and got married. And Rose called the police and had them arrested, or had him arrested because she was underage, and turned up at the police station with a gun concealed in her handbag and shot him. And she also shot someone in the boarding house that she ran. So, you know, she was a pistol-packing mama as well as a ferocious stage mother. And like I said, there's a lot more to bring out of that character, and I'd love to see it explored in a further piece. But for now, this is an excellent production of Gypsy. Really is. If like Nick, you've never seen it before, you will be blown away by it, because the combination of a really strong cast and an almost indestructible musical are unbeatable. It's interesting that no stage production has ever really strayed from the format of the Rosalind Russell, Natalie Wood movie. And that perhaps is part of its charm, that you can't change the characters in any way. You can't update it. It isn't allegorical. It wouldn't survive if you represented it in any other time or place. You know, it is Broadway and it is the 1930s, and it's nearly perfect.
We're now going to talk about Princess Ida by Gilbert and Sullivan, which is on at the Finborough Theatre. It is directed by Phil Wilmot. Web Cowgirl, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
I think first I should give a little bit of background about this production. It's advertised as not having been performed professionally in the UK for 20 years. And you have to wonder, how is it that Gilbert and Sullivan, which is, you know, so incredibly popular, especially since they ran out of their copyright, not been produced? Normally, this is a sign of a clunker, a show that probably shouldn't be on the stage. And as it turns out, the original, which was written when Gilbert and Sullivan were absolutely at the height of their powers, was somewhat unfortunately done in iambic verse, which I think would have made watching this show just painful. The songs are great. It has some very interesting characters in it. First of all, the princess herself, who is a young lady with a strong intellect. The plot for it is that Princess Ida, instead of getting married as soon as she becomes of age, is sent to in essence, a women's university. Now, according to the sentiments of the time, this was in itself funny, because why would girls want to go to school? Not only is it not suitable for what they're going to be doing for the rest of their lives, they're not actually particularly intellectually capable. So, of course, this is funny. The other really strong character who I think is right up there in terms of Gilbert and Sullivan's creation is Princess Ida's guardian, Lord Gamma. When he comes onto the stage, he basically starts talking about how incredibly clever he is, and he's almost insufferable. And he's really very, very funny. And the times when he's on stage are great. But if that were done in iambic verse, I think a lot of the forward momentum would have disappeared. So Phil Wilmot has actually substantially rewritten this play, keeping the characters, keeping the structure of the songs while not entirely sticking to the original lyrics or who performed them originally, and shaking up the dialogue so much that if you sat there with them side by side, you would not think they were the same play. The plot is the same. The plot is that Princess Ida goes to this women's university where she is sent by her guardian, who actually wants to keep her from getting married to anybody besides her. So therefore, a women's university is a great place for her to be. But she is being pursued by a bunch of young princes who wish to marry her. And in the Phil Wilmot version, it's clear that these men have no more intellectual capability than the women do. So it makes it seem a little less bad. Prince Cyril is, I believe it is Prince Cyril, he doesn't come off terribly, despite the fact that he's willing to disguise himself as a woman in order to break into a women's college. But one of the three princes that goes into it kind of makes it out that he's just going to take advantage of all the women who are there, which isn't really very nice. However, it's transformed into a play that actually looks more reflectively upon the very poor status of women in Victorian times, especially, well, I mean, of course, princesses would all be fine and all that. But one of the songs has been transformed into a plea for women to get the vote. And it is not originally done that way at all. And the final number in which everybody is resolved and some of the women are going to get married to the princes who have broken in, while some of the others are going to stay behind and carry on the university, has now been transformed into sort of a mock Victorian salute to same-sex marriage, as it were, which I thought was really very cheery and a fun way to end the show. So it is a production that is well worth seeing, not just because the show isn't performed, but because as it has been transformed by Wilmot, it is much more appealing to our modern sensibilities. And it does just have a raft of wonderful songs performed without microphones in the intimate environments of the Finborough, made for a fantastic evening and was well worth all the trouble I had to get a ticket, because it was pretty darn well near sold out even before it opened. But what's sad is that I wanted to go on the same night as Nick and had no luck whatsoever. So Nick, I still have no idea what you thought of it.
No, I really liked it as well. And it possibly is a lot to do with the sheer amount of work that's been done on it by Phil Wilmot, because I don't dislike Gilbert and Sullivan, but I don't love them either. You know, I kind of don't go out of my way to see Gilbert and Sullivan shows unless there's kind of some particular hook that makes it unique, as in this instance. Obviously, if it's showing up at the Finbury, you know, automatically it's not something you're going to see every day. And, you know, it's always interesting to see why something from creators as popular as that will have disappeared for so long. And yeah, I think probably as written, it really, well, clearly doesn't work, because otherwise people would be performing it a lot more. But I know that this was kind of part of the intention, was that it would kind of bring this back into the repertoire. And I don't see why this version shouldn't bring it back into the repertoire, because it's a lot of fun. And yeah, I mean, it's, you can see where the kind of original intention was for it to be kind of satirical of women kind of daring to get ideas above their station. But as you say, I think the version that he's come up with has kind of twisted on that, and it's sort of a lot more of a satire of that Victorian attitude in itself rather than obviously of what it was originally meant to satirize. And so it is, it's a very kind of sweet and likable and very, really funny show with just a really, really strong cast. I thought there, I think there's the odd person whose singing isn't up to the standards of the rest, but largely I think they're very well matched. I think it's interesting that Simon Butteris, who's playing Garma, is apparently quite an expert at patter songs, but of the, specifically the Gilbert and Sullivan patter songs. But actually, it's not really him who gets many of them this time. It's largely the kind of groups of princes who've got the patter songs. But yeah, I think it's well worth seeing. I mean, it's probably hard to get into now. But I mean, I would have thought this might have a further life. I know that the Finborough want to do more transfers now because they can't afford not to. And I think if it is something that could have a further life, I think either in this production or in other ones. It's certainly a lot of fun. And also, of course, being a bit more obscure, it's not one like a lot of the Gilbert and Sullivans that have a couple of the numbers that are just hugely familiar. So you're going into this quite, well, I am, because I didn't read up on it beforehand like Webb Cowgill did, but, you know, you're going into this pretty fresh as to what you're going to get. So that's always quite fun when you can find something sort of classic like that without any preconceptions. So I think it's a lot of fun.
I actually did the reading up afterwards because some of the things they said sounded so anachronistic. The song for women's suffrage, the bit at the end where the women decide to stay together as partners to run the university, from what I'd heard about the show, it didn't sound like that's what Gilbert and Sullivan would have thought was funny or would have had in their play. And it's not at all. It's how Wilmot has redone it. And I think it's made it a very appetizing play to modern sensibilities. And I would love to see this, you know, have a chance on, you know, one of the smaller West End stages. They'd have to, I think, you know, cough up a bit more money for costumes and a little bit more of a set. Although the overall look of the costumes with the Alma Tadema influence, you know, actually, I think had a very good look to it overall. They just might want to readjust some of the hemlines. I think I might have had sort of a Scottish kilt-like moment for one of the three princes. But with the voices that the cast has and really the extremely fine performance by Gama, I think that this could, and the full houses that they've had, it could definitely run for longer in a different space.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com. The podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.